Blog Talk Radio.
Transform the devastating loss of a beloved child and the overwhelming emotional pain into a purpose-driven conviction to spread love, inspiration, and encouragement for others. Stay tuned. Welcome to my radio show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, healing through love relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and Love Lessons for Your Soul. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. And in every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who just keep proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. Leanne Hull's son was a great student, a star pitcher scouted by Major League Baseball teams, and was deeply loved by his friends. And then the unthinkable happened. She lost her son to suicide. Then her husband received a cancer diagnosis, and another of her sons became alienated and estranged. Her story is one of perseverance and transformation. Leanne is determined to share with others the wisdom that she has painfully acquired. So for me, it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you today, Leanne Hull.
Thank you so much for having me on today. I'm excited to share my story.
Well, yes, it's poignant, powerful, and sad. And you've made the most, you know, like they say, to make lemonade when life gives you lemons. So please tell us briefly about your background, your family, your business experience. What was going on in your life before this happened? And then what happened? What was the effect of this situation?
Well, I have been married for 39 years, so a long-term marriage, relationship, love of my life. And we owned and operated a construction business together. I eventually became the sole owner and operator of that business as my husband went on to do other things. We have four children, two boys that are in the military, a daughter who's a nurse, and our youngest son, Andy. And then even in 2010, after running the business for 28 years, I decided to run for United States Congress. And that was a really good experience because it opened a lot of doors that were going to be important for me later on in life. Now, I came in last place, so it was, but it was the experience and the of running for the office and all of the people that I met and learning a lot about myself. So those were the things that was going on, just heavily involved in my kids and our business and raising Andy. He was 11 years younger than our first three children. So we had teenagers and we had babies, and it was a very exciting time.
Okay. And even if you're in last place, running for an office is so powerful. It's empowering to do it. And anyone who succeeded did not succeed the first time. You know, you have to build up to it. But you went in another direction.
Told me that I did not ever want to be in politics. If anything, that really made it clear that that's not someplace that I felt was going to be beneficial for me or for really anybody else. But it, like I said, it did pave the way, and I went on to work on two bills that have been implemented into law here in the state of Arizona after that, after we lost Andy. So that those contacts became very, very useful for me to get the laws in place.
That's really great that you did that. So tell us what it was like, what happened, what was going on in his life, what led to this, and who found him, how did you know about it?
Well, it was, it certainly caught us off guard. It wasn't anything we had any warning or really, in hindsight, I can see some of the really subtle signs, but nothing like what people always say, gosh, what'd you miss? How come you didn't see that? And we tend to think that people who complete suicide, that there's this particular stereotype that they're depressed for long periods of time. And of course they can be, but that's not the only way. And Andy certainly didn't fit that characterization. He was one step away from being an Eagle Scout. He was a youth leader in church. He went to winter camp, summer camp, church camp. He was being scouted as a left-handed pitcher by Major League Baseball teams and amazing universities, and just a dynamic person. His nickname was Sunshine, and that's because that's who he was. His demeanor was just filled with light and love, and he was just a bright addition to our life and the world. And so it wasn't like if you ask 100% of the people that knew Andy, 100% would tell you that he was the least likely person to ever complete suicide. There's not a single person that thought that this would have happened to Andy, not his coaches, not his youth leaders, nobody. So that's an important thing for people to recognize and understand. That's something I talk about a lot, is let that stereotype of who you think is a candidate for suicide go out the window, because it's not relevant anymore. And he started taking a drug called Accutane, which is a prescription drug for acne, about 4 months before he passed. And he had had an acne problem for a couple years and tried a lot of different topical ointments and antibiotics and all different types of things. And finally, the dermatologist said, this is a really, really effective drug. A lot of Andy's friends were on this drug. And so we gave it a whirl, and I didn't even connect the dots until after Andy passed, and the dermatologist called me and called me and called me. And he said to me, Leanne, I'm so glad you answered the phone. I am just devastated by the loss of Andy. He was the most well-adjusted kid I've ever met, and I've reported it to the FDA that the Accutane is the cause of Andy's suicide. And so then
I started
to do the research. Yeah. And I could see then some of the subtle things. It had impacted his brain, the frontal lobe, where his clear thinking goes on. And he was a little more forgetful, and he was having trouble remembering how to drive to the baseball field. He was struggling a little bit in school, and that wasn't anything he'd ever done before. And so those were some of the subtle signs that something was going on in Andy's brain that had been impacted by that drug. And then you add, he'd had a breakup with a girlfriend, so we have a drug that's impacting his brain. He's not thinking clearly. His heart is now broken, and he was being bullied by a teacher at school. And this teacher didn't like this funny, happy kid. Sometimes there's just that personality conflict. And she was going to fail him in that one class, and that was going to make him ineligible for baseball, and it was going to impact the scouts. And so for Andy, with him not thinking clearly, his heart being broken, and then feeling like his world, his future was shattered, one bad impulsive moment, he left school early, which he'd never walked out of school before. He left right after second hour, right after the class of the teacher who failed him. and it was right at winter break, so baseball season was coming up, and he felt like the writing was on the wall. Even though that wasn't the case, and we'd been talking about that, he, in his 16-year-old brain that wasn't working clearly, he didn't believe that. And so he wandered around for about 5 hours and eventually ended up back at our house and shot himself in our bed, in his bedroom. And a friend of mine actually found him as he went over to my house, and I was at work, and I couldn't get a hold of Andy after school, and that was odd. And so I'd asked him to stop by the house, and so he did. And then when I couldn't get a hold of him, I closed my computer and headed home, and the first thing I saw were all the first responders at my house, and the story began.
Whoa, what a story, how sad. Yeah, so sad.
Yeah.
That you've taken innocent drugs and then the life circumstances, you know, it all piles up.
Right.
What was it like for you and your whole family once this event happened?
Well, you're in a state of shock, actually, thank God for shock, because it does allow you to function to a certain degree. So that's definitely the benefit of that. And I'm sorry, there are sirens around here.
It's okay.
Okay, so the shock does allow you to function. And of course, we're all devastated. It's a very difficult to explain what that was like at the beginning. I do remember that my daughter and my grandkids were living with me at this time. And their concern was, you know, where are we going to live, Mom? And where are we going to live, Grandma? And I knew that we needed to go home that night. I knew that even though Andy had done this in our house, we needed to go home and figure out how to live after this. And so we waited till the medical examiner was done, the coroner, whoever shows up out at the house, and we eventually made our way home that night. And, you know, the first thing that I see walking through the front door is my son in a body bag. And I wrapped my arms around him and hugged him and said goodbye. And then I have been blessed with the gift of sleep from day one. And so they told me not to go in his room until the restoration people had come. And, of course, I'm not masochistic, so I didn't. And I did go to sleep somewhere around midnight and woke up at 4. And I do remember hearing the restoration people in there somewhere that night. And so I knew it was safe to go in his room. And when I walked in his room, I saw this big, huge, royal blue heart painted on the floor of the concrete, because they'd ripped out the concrete, out the carpet. And my daughter, that night, while I was sleeping, after the restoration people had finished, she went in there and painted the blue heart over the blood that had stained on the concrete so that I wouldn't see it.
Wow.
So when I was standing there, she came down the hall and she said, Mom, I did this for you. And we just laid across the heart and cried and cried. And then Andy's friends came over later that day and we all wrote things around that blue heart that's still there on the concrete. And began the process moving forward.
Wow. So you've had a lot of love in your life around you.
Yes, it didn't come from the places that I thought it was going to come from, which was really interesting. I think most people think that, and maybe some people do. So my story is just my story. It doesn't mean this is the way for everybody. But my family was not a source of comfort and support for me, because my family was all in such a state of shock and trying to figure out their own way forward. And my two best friends I never saw them after Andy's memorial service. They never called again. They never showed up at my house. So I had to find new sources of comfort and support in order to be able to have some companionship going through this journey. And I did, but it took a while.
But I think that people just can't cope with it. They have such
right.
a fear for their own life. It's very sad that they can't be there for you. But you managed to find people.
Yeah, I did. And the people that are in my life now, for the most part, are other parents who've lost children. But they're parents also with the same mindset that I have, because there are a lot of people that get really stuck in their sadness and grief and don't ever move forward. And those are not the people that are in my life. They're people who, of course, we get sad. And of course, there are days that trigger us and we would do anything, give anything to have our kids back. But in general, we have found a way to go on with our lives and laugh and love and enjoy our other children and our grandchildren, and we share life together, and we talk about our kids all the time. And other people are afraid to talk about our kids. They're afraid of even bringing them up for fear that it'll make us sad, and it might, but we want to talk about our children. We don't want our children to be forgotten. So that's really important for other people to understand, is that to not shy away from talking about someone's loved one because you're afraid it's going to make them sad. Hey, if they tell you not to, then of course don't. But for the most part, most people really want to talk about their loved ones.
My brother lost his son I forgot how old he was, like 4 and a half, with holes in his heart. And they still like to talk about him. He's a beautiful little boy. You know, it's honoring that person when you talk about him.
Absolutely. And without a doubt, I also believe that Andy isn't floating around in heaven somewhere, which, you know, that was really my Christian beliefs. I now know that he's alive in spirit, and I can talk to him here, I don't have that same kind of physical relationship with him, but I definitely feel like he's here in spirit with me oftentimes. And so I'm going to make the most of that time that I have
with
him. And
we were talking, that's beautiful. We were talking before we got on the air, and I had asked, you know, how did you feel like going on living after this big loss? And I thought, or said to you, well, you have other children and you can focus your attention on them, but you had a different response. So please share that, because I'm sure that's really common.
Yes, and that's why I wrote, that's the title of the book, How to Live When You Want to Die, because that is truly how I felt. I wanted to die every single day after Andy passed for at least the first 2 years. And as the third year, I felt some relief at that point. And so those times of wanting to die were less frequent and less intense, but they still reared their ugly head at times. And so people would say, oh, well, you have other children and you have grandchildren, and you know, none of that made a difference to me. When I was in those moments, when I came very close to acting upon that, the pain was just so intense that you're not thinking clearly, just like Andy. You're not thinking clearly. And so you just want the pain to stop. And that's the challenge with kids, is that they don't have any reference point that they can work their way through it. Fortunately, even in those darkest of moments, I did have some glimmers of, I had some coping tools that I had already established in advance. And those were my life-saving tools that I used in those fleeting moments. And I would have to develop many more new tools to survive you know, the coming months and years. But those were the ones that kept me here momentarily.
So can you share what you mean by what kind of coping tool?
You know, I did have a really strong foundation of faith. And what I knew is that faith is really displayed when things go bad in your life. Anybody can have faith when your life seems good, when everything seems as it should be. So that's easy. But who are you when your world is rocked? And I had a very extensive knowledge of the Bible, and so I understood that the Bible is not filled with happy stories. It is filled with tragedies and traumas, and those people displayed faith in the midst of their tragedies and their traumas. And so I knew mm-hmm. that, and I thought in that moment, and people from the Holocaust and, you know, all of those things that I'd read and learned in the past, I understood if other people could survive tragedies and traumas in their life, then so could I. And so having been a well-read person, I had a lot of references to other people and other situations where people had survived. I did something that I know was really very important for me. You know, it's interesting that first night, within an hour after Andy passed, and I managed to get up off the concrete, I'm sitting at the neighbor's house because they wouldn't let me go in my house, and friends and Andy's friends started showing up. And the first thing that everybody wanted to do was pour me a glass of wine and give me a Xanax, because not because they mm-hmm. wanted to hurt me, but because they wanted to anesthetize me, to calm me, and I knew in that moment that alcohol is a depressant. And so these thoughts going through my head, do you think I could have been any more depressed? And is it wise to add a depressant to a depressed person? No. So I pushed the alcohol away that night. I pushed the Xanax away that night. And I didn't drink for the first year after Andy died, because I knew that one drink would have altered my ability to think clearly and hold on to life. It would have enforced my sadness, and I would have acted upon my desire to end my life.
Mm.
So
and
that was
said,
really powerful.
Mm. You also said at some point that your husband was diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah, it's interesting. What we understand now is that I began a foundation almost right after. I gave my first presentation 4 months after Andy passed to 3,000 kids, and I talked about suicide awareness and prevention and You Matter, because I didn't want Andy's friends to follow in their footsteps, in his footsteps. And so my talking about it, I allowed my grief to come out, and it was channeled into a purpose and a passion. Now, that didn't mean I wasn't sad. Of course, just like I said, I wanted to die every day the first 2 years, but I was still doing things to try to move me forward. And my husband didn't talk about Andy. And so his grief, we believe, manifested itself in the form of cancer 6 months after Andy passed. Stage 4 cancer and melanoma, and he had a big tumor on his head, and they about the size of a medium-sized orange underneath his scalp. And they did the surgery, and then they told him that he was only going to have 2 years to live. And that was even with chemo and radiation. So at that point, neither one of us really cared whether we lived or died. So we walked out of that after he had the surgery. You know, we did get rid of the tumor, but we didn't want to compromise whatever time that we felt he had left by being sick. And so he started a regimen of, he changed his diet, he became a vegan, did a lot of cancer research, and here he is, almost 7 years now, cancer-free, never had any reoccurrence. The doctor thinks it's bizarre, and he's the healthiest guy on the job site where he works. He just doesn't even get a cold or the flu, and just was a very healing, very interesting to see the power of food and what we put into our bodies as well as what we put into our brains.
But also the power of love, you know, he loved himself enough to change his diet and to do it.
We just recently talked about that. That's not the case, though. It wasn't about love for himself because he didn't. And it's only now that he is starting to claim his own life again. He did that for me. He didn't do that for him. So I thought that was really interesting because he really, honestly, he really didn't care whether he was here or not. He just didn't want to be sick while he was here. And then as time went on, he wanted to make sure I was financially okay as long as he could. And so that was his reason to stay.
Well, it was love. Maybe not so much love for himself.
Yeah, for someone else, just not for himself.
Maybe it's easier that way.
I think so. It's
funny. So how did you push past all this pain and to start to write? What led you to start writing about it?
You know, I've had people say to me recently, oh gosh, Leanne, that must have been really cathartic for you to write. And it was interesting because it wasn't cathartic for me to write because the catharsis had already happened. I didn't start writing till I was 3 years into the journey. And then I thought, wow, I can't believe I survived this. And I really want to share the things that I did in order to get to that place where I felt like that dark, dark cloud had lifted off of over my head. And I thought that the things, they would be valuable for other people going through traumas or tragedies. And so I wrote that summer, the third year after Andy had passed, and then I didn't write again till the following summer. And then I just finished this last summer. So I really wrote 3 summers, and that's it. And it was just like it was divinely delivered to me. The information, I couldn't type fast enough. And then I was done. And it would be another year before I would write again. So, but then it was because I had more growing to do. And so that was finally, you know, by the time I finished, there was so much change that had occurred in me and my life that it was amazing. And that's what the book is about, is taking charge of your life, really.
So what part have Andy's friends and your family and friends played in your recovering and dealing with all of this?
Well, Andy's friends played a pretty big part for the first 2 years in that Andy was a junior when he passed. And so really until those kids graduated as seniors, you know, we were all pretty involved. I was attending all of their baseball games every year. They would still come over to the house. We were doing lots of things for the foundation to promote our You Matter message, and they were involved in it. But then as they graduated and they went off to college, you know, there are a handful, about a handful of the kids that have stayed in touch. The rest of them, it's not that they've forgotten Andy. They had to go on. And I feel like what we did those first 2 years gave them a really valuable foundation to move forward with of how are you going to survive something that's so terrible in your life. They saw how I was handling it. We shared the journey together. We laughed. We cried. And yet we just kept moving forward. And so I think that it was a huge service for Andy's friends, what we did in doing this so vocally and so visually. You know, they saw everything that was going on in our life, and we shared it together. My other kids, my 2 boys are military, and within the military confines, it's a very difficult to process loss or grief. That's why the suicide rate is so high in the military, in a nutshell. I mean, there's lots of reasons, but in a just a nutshell it. And my boys are perfect examples of that. The one hasn't spoken to us in about four, it'll be 4 years this January, because he just can't figure out how to move on with his career and be successful with that and still deal with his family, who is a constant reminder of what happened, the tragedy that happened. He can't do that for whatever reason. And he lost his wife of 10 years. And so I lost a daughter-in-law in addition. And then my other son, also, he was serving in the Persian Gulf when Andy died. And his coping tools when he got home, he chose alcohol. And that didn't help his process. And he lost his wife of 10 years. I lost another daughter-in-law. And he's doing better now, but it was 2 years of he attempted suicide twice after Andy passed, and he is now permanently disabled with PTSD. Just very traumatic for my boys. My daughter's a nurse, and she had better coping skills, and she also has three kids that, you know, shared this journey with us, and so she will continue to do well and be a major part of my life. And as well as the grandchildren, of course. But tremendous loss
so
in
much
our family.
More that, right, so much more that happens that people don't realize. It's not just that person, but there's the whole family and the effect on everybody. It's enormous.
Right, I call it compounded grief. Lots and lots of ripple effect fallout from that. And mostly you can't really talk to people about that because they can barely handle the fact that you lost your child, period. And then if you want to add on my husband's cancer and my other boys and my daughter-in-law's, they're just like, it's too much for them. So I don't share that with most people in that sense, in a general conversation. They just can't deal
but
with it.
But there's also that saying, it doesn't rain, but it pours. You know,
boy,
so
it
when
did.
Something happens, it certainly happens. So
yeah,
tell
it
us
poured,
about
for
your
sure.
foundation and your book and maybe some live events, whatever you're doing, to share how people could contact you, get your book, find out about the foundation, etc.
I love our foundation, the work we're doing in that. We started that, like I said, I gave my first presentation about 4 months after Andy passed, and it was at his school, and then the neighboring schools heard about that, and they asked me to come and speak, and then doors just started flying open, and so I, you know, began, my speech grew and evolved to craft a speech that had integrity and meaning, and then we, you know, I wanted to do something for Andy's birthday that was April. And it was, again, right at that four-month period after he had passed. He passed in December. And so we decided to do an event at the local amusement park. And we sold tickets for it because I was going to bring in, I brought in lots of other professionals because I'm not the professional. I'm just a mom. So I brought in other suicide prevention organizations and help groups so that while the kids could come and have fun at this amusement park, we could also reinforce them with resources and other tools so that if anyone else was contemplating or thinking about hurting themselves, they were going to be provided with information there. And in the process of selling the tickets, we ended up raising $10,000 for that event. Lots and lots of people showed up. And what we were like, well, what do we do with this money? So that's when we established the foundation, and we started to do You Matter scholarships that year. We gave away 10 $1,000 You Matter scholarships to graduating seniors. And they had to write essays on why they mattered or how they perceived that they mattered and how they could take that You Matter message forward as they went on to college. And it wasn't based on any GPA or anything like that. It was just the depth of thought that they put into their essay. So that was so interesting and loved doing that. And then we continued raising money and doing those types of events, you know, giving scholarships. But ultimately, I think our biggest ministry are our You Matter wristbands. So they're yellow wristbands that say You Matter on them, and they have our website on them, and they're free to anybody. We ship them literally all over the world. All anybody has to do is go on our website, fill out the form of who they're for, what they want them, why they want them, and how they're going to be used. And I just had a school in Washington email us, reach out, and they had had a suicide in their high school. And she said, can I have 2,100 wristbands for all the rest of the kids in the school? You bet. We shipped them. We've shipped them to Australia, Nigeria, Scotland, all over the world. And there are times people will just write in and request one wristband. Can I just have one wristband? You know, I'm not feeling so good myself, and I just need it for myself. So, yes, we'll ship you one wristband. And that's, we do fundraising to raise money for that. I love that. I love the letters I get from people. The website is andyssunshine.com. So andyssunshine.com. The foundation is called Andy Hull's Sunshine Foundation.
And how can they get your book?
So my book is How to Live When You Want to Die, and that's on my website. It's also on Amazon, so you can get it from Amazon in paper or Kindle, or you can get it off of my website, and that's leannhull.com, leannhull.com. And the difference between Amazon and my website is Amazon, the pictures in the book are in black and white, because Amazon's so expensive to put them in color. If you order them off of my website, you get the pictures in color.
Nice. Well, do you have any final words that you could share with our listeners that are coping with some kind of huge trauma or loss?
It probably a couple of things. Most importantly, you know, oftentimes we can't choose what happens to us, but we absolutely 100% are able to choose how we respond, whether we get help, whether we have the tools to do it ourselves, whatever that looks like. You can make a choice to change your life if you're not happy with where you're at, and then to be patient with the process, because so many of the things that we do, we're an instant gratification society. And so many of our processes, they're going to take time to really work. For me, it took 2 years of practicing lots of good, healthy coping skills before I really saw the fruits of my efforts. But I worked at it and worked at it and worked at it. Mental health is something that we need to be vigilant about and take as much care about our mental health as we do our physical health.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's beautiful, Leanne. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you. Reach out and tell someone today that they matter to you. Tell them you matter to me.
Wow, we need more of that for sure.
Thank you.
And to those of you listening, I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, drericagoodstone.com, where you can apply for a complimentary Healing Through Love session and browse the site to help you heal through love. And also, I have a new Kindle book based on Wallace D. Waddell's book written in 1910 called The Science of Being Well. And it's just beautifully written, and it explains what it takes to be healthy and well in the world. Bye for now.